Hello, and welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm Chuck Stanley, senior reporter for Infralogic, and today I'm joined by Alan Marks, a partner with Milbank's Global Project Energy and Infrastructure Group. As our listeners have no doubt heard, it's an election year in the United States, and the two major parties could not be further apart in their policy objectives for renewable energy. Alan is one of the experts we spoke to at Infralogic for our look at how investors and project sponsors in the renewable space are managing the political uncertainty surrounding the election. I encourage everyone to check that story out at ionanalytics.com, but as has become an evergreen statement in American politics, a lot has happened in the few short weeks since that story ran. So there's plenty of new ground for us to cover. Alan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Chuck. It's a real pleasure.
Well, first of all, I wonder if you could briefly introduce yourself for those who haven't heard you on the podcast before and tell those listeners who aren't familiar with you about the work you do with Milbank.
Sure. I'm a partner at Milbank and have been working in renewable energy and other infrastructure for over 30 years. My clients include project developers and sponsors, private equity funds and infrastructure funds, investing in either new or operating assets, as well as other parties to some of these transactions.
And as listeners who are familiar with your previous appearances on the podcast or have read your great analysis that you write for Milbank, your depth of knowledge in the space is unparalleled. So we're really lucky to have you on the show today.
Well, thanks very much.
Oh, absolutely. When we spoke for our Infralogic story on the election, you said that investors in the renewable energy sector have become less sanguine about the potential impacts on the sector from the elections in November. Could you tell me a little bit about how investor attitudes have changed in recent months with regard to the elections?
Sure, happy to. I think investor attitudes have to be viewed as in a context. Most people in an election year don't focus too closely on the policy outcomes of the election or significant economic changes until the election is closer. And investors are no different than anyone else in that regard. I think with respect to investors, a lot of the increasing focus you'll see being brought to the potential different outcomes of the election relate to first significant policy differences, especially in areas of energy and climate between the two candidates. The Republicans have nominated Donald Trump, of course, and it looks that Kamala Harris will become the Democratic nominee at their upcoming convention. And the parties certainly have different policies on that. I think we're also in the context of coming through a period of the last, say, 3 or 4 years with significant uncertainty about the economy, which is doing, I think, much better than most people would have expected, and also about geopolitics and some of the other broader risks that do impact both international investment into the United States, especially in the energy sector, and also energy as an asset class globally. So as people focus coming into the election on an outcome which is uncertain and binary, that could have dramatic effects on their investments, either pro or con, depending on the types of investments they're doing, that's going to get a renewed attention. If this was an election which was not close, if this is an election that had parties or candidates that were more similar in their policies, and if we had not gone through the uncertainty of foreign wars and COVID pandemics and the recovery from it and a lot of those things, then I think we'd be in a different situation.
And I mean, obviously, the major legislative support for the renewables sector during the Biden administration has come from the Inflation Reduction Act and the many renewable energy incentives included in that legislation. Throughout our reporting on the election and investor attitudes towards it, we've heard over and over again that the core incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act are expected to remain intact regardless of the election outcome. As you indicated during your remarks, it's been an extremely volatile few weeks in American politics. Are industry experts still confident that those core provisions are insulated from major changes or rollbacks in the event of a big GOP win in November?
It's certainly the case that if the Democratic candidate is elected, if Kamala Harris becomes president, or if the Democrats are able to take control of the House or retain control of the Senate, which may depend in large part on how the White House goes, that you will see not just a preservation of renewable energy incentives and other provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act, but probably an expansion of policies that are meant to foster growth of renewable energy and other climate-friendly investments, including EVs and so forth. If the Republicans were to win the White House, especially if they were to control the White House and both chambers of Congress, I do think we'd see significant changes in policy. Now, that does not necessarily mean that the Inflation Reduction Act gets repealed. I don't think there are enough votes in even a Republican-controlled Senate to do that, despite what the House might do or what the White House might like. There's a lot of reasons for that. For one thing, the benefits of investments that have been spurred by the Inflation Reduction Act do accrue to both, you know, red states and blue states. And if you actually dig down more deeply, the majority of the investments in clean energy facilities have come in counties or districts that are Republican or Republican-leaning. Almost 2 out of every 3 jobs that have been created have been in Republican counties or districts. And then the investments in clean energy manufacturing facilities, there's some in New York, there's some in California, but there's quite a bit in states like North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, Georgia, Arkansas, Indiana, Ohio, and others that tend to lean Republican. So a lot of members of Congress have a vested interest in the provisions of the law that are promoting growth and job creation in their states or their districts continuing. Having said that, I think there's also clearly in the Republican platform, in Project 2025, which is from the Heritage Foundation, but associated with many of the people that either were in the last Trump administration or are likely to be in the next one if he's elected, quite a number of provisions that would seek to roll back the capacity of the federal government to encourage or mandate decarbonization writ large. So how would government agencies be staffed? Which agencies would continue? How would tax guidance and other regulations that come out of the broad range of federal agencies that can impact that investment, you know, how would those play out? So even if you have, imagine every provision of the Inflation Reduction Act stays intact, there's still a large a question mark, I think, over how the government would function, what the government's policies would be from a regulatory side and from an enforcement side, and you would have to see how that plays out.
And among the big changes in the political landscape in the past few weeks has been both the announcement of J.D. Vance as the vice presidential candidate for Donald Trump and the emergence of Kamala Harris as, I think it's safe to say, that she is the presumptive Democratic nominee for president now that Joe Biden has announced he will no longer run for the nomination. Do either of these developments significantly change the outlook for energy policy outcomes from the election?
I don't think so. I mean, Kamala Harris, let's start there. I think she would be expected to continue the policies that the Biden-Harris administration has already had with respect to being in favor of renewable energy, generally speaking, exposed to expanding drilling for oil and gas on federal lands, and supportive of newer technologies like green hydrogen. The administration has also supported blue hydrogen and carbon capture and storage, both in the hydrogen hub proposals that have been approved and funded or approved for funding from the federal government and in some of their other policies. The Inflation Reduction Act, of course, has significant incentives for CCS and for hydrogen in several colors. I think I would expect those policies to continue. I think the export limitations on LNG, or more precisely, the Biden administration's suspension of approvals for new export permits for new LNG facilities, I suspect that that might not continue after the election, regardless of who's elected, in part because of regulatory requirements and in part because of the demands for natural gas in Europe, especially imports from the United States, which has a pretty big geopolitical significance. And stabilizing or continuing a more stable supply of energy in Europe, it has big international geopolitical consequences. And I think you would see a President Harris or a Harris administration also continue U.S. involvement in global climate talks and the mechanism and framework underneath the Paris Agreement. In contrast, if there was another Trump administration, I suspect you would see an attempt to roll back support for electronic vehicles and the national government's role in EV charging. I think you'd see a big push for expansion of new exploration and development of fossil fuel assets, oil and gas, both on federal lands and in the continental shelf. I suspect you would see an attempt to roll back some of the greenhouse gas emissions limitations, which have either been adopted or proposed by the EPA, even though those rules have largely been upheld, most recently by the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, and at least implicitly, occasionally even explicitly since the Massachusetts decision, by the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, it's interesting too, if you look at judicial appointments and what that could mean for how courts interpret federal authority, there's some question as to whether agencies could have a dramatic 180 regulatory pivot, for example, in finding with respect to the harm of greenhouse gas emissions and climate impacts and how relevant that is or not to the EPA's regulatory authority. In some ways, the courts have made it more difficult in recent decisions for agencies to have kind of unfettered discretion in changing their determinations. So that could make it ironically harder for a Trump administration to make, you know, significant changes on that score. I think that there is in the current Supreme Court, and certainly in more conservative circuits like the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, a lot of concern about regulatory overreach when it comes to regulations that have a significant impact or a major question for the economy, or that suggest that an agency is exceeding what Congress would have delegated to it as far as statutory authority.
Right. And I think to your point, it's fairly easy to imagine if, say, a GOP-staffed EPA or FERC decides to volunteer that they don't have the authority to regulate certain aspects of the climate or the energy sector. I can imagine the court appointments coming from the Trump administration to be more sympathetic to that sort of regulatory logic than a more forceful effort to impose federal regulations from the executive branch on carbon emissions.
That's right. If you just look at greenhouse gas emissions, CO2 and other greenhouse gases, you know, the Massachusetts EPA case basically determined that the EPA has both the authority and the duty to regulate those emissions. If you flash forward to the West Virginia versus EPA case, which more significantly reined in what the EPA can do, in particular looking at cross-state emissions policies, the court left intact the interpretation of the Clean Air Act that the EPA should be regulating greenhouse gas emissions. And if you look at the most recent ruling out of the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, it's pretty clear that if the EPA does that in a direct way, the same way that it regulates other pollutants from stationary sources, that's well within the EPA's authority. If the EPA were suddenly to decide that it chooses not to regulate air pollution, that would violate the intent of Congress as expressed in the Clean Air Act and other laws. And I think there could be some judicial pushback to that, even from a conservative court.
Absolutely. And drilling down a bit deeper, it sounds like the political risk exposure isn't uniform across the renewable space. Are there corners of the renewable energy sector that have more to gain or to lose from this election?
Yeah, I think so. If you look at winners, I think onshore wind, I think solar and energy storage, maybe even electric transmission, all of those probably will have enough, if you will, critical mass and momentum from both economic drivers, from state regulatory policies, and from technological improvements, that those might continue regardless. If you look at other areas that are especially meant to be stimulated by Biden-Harris policies and by laws passed in the last 4 years, and here I would not include not just the Inflation Reduction Act, but also the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, I think the CHIPS Act, because that certainly is a big part of the broader industrial policy theme of having the federal government incentivize or subsidize, often through tax breaks, certain types of investment. If you look at those types of things and compare with the possibility of what might change in election outcome, I think, again, if Harris is elected to succeed Biden, then you'll see kind of more of the same and continuity and stability in federal policy. If Trump is elected, you'll probably see a greater push to support oil and gas, potentially maybe even coal, although coal is today only about 20% of U.S. power generation as a resource and is, for economic reasons and other non-climate environmental reasons, less favored than it has been in the past. I think areas like green hydrogen, where the federal government has provided initiatives through the hydrogen hubs, which are part of the laws and the package approved by Congress, that may have some headwinds. Anything depending on federal loan guarantees, especially for more innovative clean energy technologies, may be impacted. And if you look at how energy is used, because it's not just a question of how energy is generated, we can't look at that in isolation. That's where I think you might see some other changes. You know, right now, if you look at projections of growth in GDP generally, but also in energy in particular, in the United States, we have a significant growth right now in demand for electricity. Now, what's driving that? Some of that is AI-driven, you know, investment in data centers and digitization of other parts of the economy. So that, I think, will continue regardless of who's occupying the White House. If you look at electrification and mobility, that's where you see some really big differences. Right now, the transportation sector is the largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions, and one of the harder to abate sectors if you don't have a shift to EVs, or potentially hydrogen fuel cells or other technologies, not just for cars, but also for heavy duty vehicles and for trucks and for freight, and potentially including electrification of rail, sustainable aviation fuels for jet aircraft, especially cargo-based marine traffic. So that's an area where you have, I think, a bigger challenge and a bigger opportunity for greenhouse gas emissions reductions. And that's one where the two candidates really would have different policies. For EVs in particular, it doesn't do you a lot of good if you plug in your EV to an electric grid that's not also being decarbonized. That may increase costs. It certainly increases exposure to volatile fossil fuel prices, and it certainly does not alleviate greenhouse gas emissions. So that interplay between energy generation, energy use, and changes in load or demand, and other sectors, whether that's transportation or agriculture or buildings or hard-to-abate industrial heat, how those things all fit together kind of require a holistic approach and not just looking at these things in silos and certainly not just looking at as a preferred energy source or preferred sector of the energy market in which to invest. So that whole of government thinking and that holistic approach that tries to improve the quality of digital communications, improve the quality of transportation and transportation networks, while at the same time making the energy sector more efficient and potentially, you know, cleaner. I think how those things come together really depends a lot on the approach. And if you have a government which doesn't take that type of a holistic approach, then you're likelier to get either uneven investment or inefficient investment and capital allocation, or kind of a lot of unpredictability in potential policies, which could chill investment.
And I know we invited you on to talk about election-specific matters, but we did recently get a pretty big piece of news out of Congress. Senators Joe Manchin and John Barrasso recently introduced long-awaited legislation aimed at streamlining the permitting process for major infrastructure projects, including energy and transmission. There's not a lot of time left between now and the end of the year, and that's before you take into account the amount of energy that's going to be dedicated to the presidential and congressional campaigns. Is there much in the way of possibility for this legislation to move forward during the current session?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, we've had permitting legislation introduced before, most recently, in fact, with the support of some of the same people supporting this bill, including Senator Manchin, and with the support of the White House, as announced by President Biden, even though they didn't agree with all of the things in the prior permitting legislation. The one that's come out now, most recently, is it's labeled a bipartisan permitting bill. I'm not sure that that's really an accurate label. Senator Manchin, some of the Republican senators that are in support of it, have included in it many things that both parties like. They've also included in it provisions that I think are kind of dead on arrival in the Senate this year, which is still controlled by Democrats. So to be specific, if you look back to the bipartisan infrastructure bill, there were proposals made which were adopted by Congress and have now already being implemented by the administration, Fast 41 in particular, that were meant to streamline federal permitting. They didn't really go far enough, but some of those things included a single federal dashboard for permits and approvals, better interagency coordination, kind of processing permits in parallel instead of just serially, shortening the statute of limitations for certain types of major federal projects that were subject to NEPA and other laws, and that were where there was transparency in the permitting on the federal dashboard, and shortening that statute of limitations from 6 years, which is the general statute of limitations that is subject for a lot of these government actions, down to 2 years. So that was a lot of progress. And for big projects, say over $200 million, that was a lot of help. What we did not see was clear federal preemption in order to facilitate interstate or regional electric transmission, which I think is one of the major things that has to be done to make our energy sector more reliable and more efficient, and also to facilitate the increase in renewable energy sources that are remote from load centers, and to allow those transfers of power from places where it's being generated, especially by intermittent resources, into areas where the load is growing. And some of that is, you know, urban areas, for example, where you have growth in manufacturing and you have a lot of people that need to turn on the air conditioning in the afternoon. But some of it is also in places that are remote. Data centers come to mind, and some of the manufacturing that's being built in exurban or rural areas. So I think both parties would support the provisions of, as they did in the prior iterations of this permitting reform. I think they would support what's in the Manchin-Barrasso bill on streamlining permitting at the federal level for for interstate and regional transmission. Similarly, I think there's other provisions in it that would be favorable for renewable energy that, frankly, both parties, at least historically, have supported. In contrast, though, there's other provisions in the bill that would greatly increase in sort of mandate by congressional action, more leasing for oil and gas on federal lands. It would require the federal government to have at least annual auctions for offshore energy, both for offshore wind and for offshore oil and gas. And that's what, if you pause on that for a minute, it kind of tells you why there's some things that are almost like poison pills in the particular permitting legislation. Historically, before a couple of years ago, if the federal government under the Outer Continental Shelf Act wanted to lease areas for oil and gas, it could do so, and it did. There were regular procedures to go through for that. Most of the lease areas were either not bid on, or if they were bid on, they were not developed because functionally there's, you know, a lot of other macroeconomic concerns as to whether it's justified to, if you're an oil company or a gas company, to actually develop all those reserves, but you have the right to do so. And similarly, if there was investment in offshore wind, that was done under regular auctions that the Bureau of Offshore Energy Management would undertake. And there have been successful auctions on the U.S. East Coast and the Northeast, and projects are now either newly in operation or about to start construction or in various stages of development, especially in New York and in Massachusetts. We're seeing that further down the Atlantic coast. They've had successful auctions in California, although those projects are further out in their development. And there are prospects for offshore wind, just as there has been historically for oil and gas development, significantly in the Gulf of Mexico. Every time the government gives a lease for energy, whether that's fossil fuels or wind or anything else, onshore solar, for example, on BLM lands, Bureau of Land Management, onshore federal lands, those developments are subject to environmental approvals. And one of the things that the new Manchin legislation would do, the Manchin-Barroso permitting bill would do, is to mandate that those lease auctions be held, the leases be granted, and sort of push them through irrespective of some of the other concerns that might otherwise dictate how the government, especially the Bureau of Land Management, decides which areas should be leased. So if there are sensitive habitats, if there are areas where there are endangered species, if there are areas where there may be native or archaeological sites, you know, most of those concerns would kind of get swept away. And without any transparency, really. Also in the new proposed bill, there's a further reduction of the statute of limitations down to 150 days from federal action, which is really short. Not clear when that would start. It would apply to projects that are subject not just to environmental impact statements, which is current law, but also to environmental assessments, which is a much lower standard. And, you know, a project could get approved and pushed through and 150 days could go by and no one would even know. So that, you know, arguably undercuts the idea of transparency and participation in the process. There are a lot of provisions in the bill that I just cannot see, you know, the Democrats supporting. I suspect there are some Republicans that also might not support it. So calling it a bipartisan permitting reform is a little bit optimistic.
So not something that we're likely to see just a bipartisan consensus rally around trying to get this thing across the finish line either this year or even possibly in the next session.
Well, let's make a distinction between this year and the next session. I think this year, look, it's an election year. It's highly unlikely that Congress is going to do anything that's, you know, radical or dramatic or impactful in an election year, in part because neither party wants to give the other one a win, even when they agree, and in part because they simply disagree, and in part because there's not a lot of time. You know, we've got the August recess. People are out campaigning for re-election in their home districts. They're not, you know, in Washington trying to hammer out things in committee rooms to find a bipartisan consensus, at least not around things that are not viewed by them as being urgent, even if they're important. Now, after the election, we'll all know which direction things are going. And that means that a lame duck session in Congress maybe could accomplish things. In the past, it certainly has. And there will be significant impetus to get things done at year end, in part because of other things related to the debt ceiling and related to budgeting that'll become more important coming into January 2025. So knowing the outcome of the election will impact what happens or whether there's new log jams that are thrown up during the lame duck session of Congress at the end of the year. Next year, we'll have someone new in the White House by definition, whether that's President Harris or President Trump. We will have a new Congress, whichever parties are in control. And in that situation, I do think, in fact, that the prospects for federal legislation to further streamline permitting of energy projects will probably find broader support, probably even true bipartisan support, certainly around things like removing the log jams on permitting and siting for energy generation facilities, certainly around removing the log jams on interconnection and interconnection queues and giving FERC perhaps more authority to assist the state regulators and the regional transmission organizations on how to streamline the backlog and interconnection. That's true in red states and blue states. It's true for, you know, all of the new energy projects that are going to be needed to meet the new demand that I mentioned before from transportation and from digital infrastructure and just economic growth and manufacturing growth. And I think you'll see the transmission lines in particular for interstate and regional transmission being facilitated by some kind of permitting reform in the next Congress. I just think that that's essential regardless of one's political party.
So might you expect this legislation to be sort of the jumping off point from which Congress in 2025 begins to work on something that could eventually pass into legislation?
Not necessarily this bill. I think there are other permitting bills that have been introduced in the past that probably are more likely jumping off points if you're trying to get a bipartisan consensus.
Well, I'm sure if past is prologue, there's going to be about a million twists and turns for us to follow between now and when we hopefully have a chance to join up on the podcast again to talk about some prospective permitting legislation in 2025. Fortunately, that is all the time we have today. Alan, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Chuck. It's my pleasure.
That is all the time we have for this episode of Crossroads, the Infrastructure Podcast. Don't forget to rate, follow, and review us on the podcast application of your choice. I'm Chuck Stanley. Until next time, thanks for listening.